outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey. The God Journey.
Wow, 1001, Wayne.
Yeah, well, we're going to number them all from here on out.
No, I was just laughing because I was thinking, okay, you know, 101 Dalmatians. Now we got 1001 Dalmatians, except for 1001 conversations with Wayne and Kyle.
Well, I think I must have partied too hard afterwards. I'm kind of a bit under the weather today. So we're going to see how this recording works. I started last night not sleeping well and feeling kind of cruddy. And then I had some hallucination kinds of things, which were definitely not godly things. They were just weird things. And and while I was wide awake. And so that was odd. But then my doctor didn't worry about if you know they're not real, then you're all good. Okay. I knew they weren't real. But so then this morning, getting up, I'm doing a lot of recording now for It's Time, putting it in audio. And didn't have the voice today, and it's just steadily gone downhill. So we're going to try and make it through this podcast, see if it works.
All right, let's see where we land today.
Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. You got a best thing you heard this week?
I do. I'm not sure if it's the best thing or not, honestly.
It could be the worst thing.
It stuck with me, and I'm not sure how to process it, but I was watching a television show the other day, and the sidekick in the story is talking to the main character, and the main character is at the point in the hero's journey where they're trying to decide, are they going to overcome this major challenge? So the TV show is Scandal. I don't know if you're familiar with the show, but...
Yeah, I watched it years ago.
Yeah, so for some reason decided I was going to start rewatching it because there was a couple of seasons that I had missed. And so I was like, oh, I'll go back into it and try it. And the quote that came out of it was, some men aren't meant to be happy. They are meant to be great. And I don't know how that, I mean, it just has landed with me and it stayed with me. And I'm not sure what to do with that comment, honestly.
Well, why did it land with you?
I don't think I necessarily agree. Like that. So the whole conversation of this quote, the context around this quote was they're talking about the president, right? And he's evaluating, should I just allow this presidency thing to go to the wayside? What if I was to resign? Like there's some drama there always is in that show. Like there's some drama that they're trying to deal with. And his chief of staff is talking about him and it says that some men aren't meant to be happy. They're meant to be great. And it's talking about how he was set for this destiny to be president. And he's having to make all these major life sacrifices in regards to his own heart or what his preferences would be or how he would choose to live his life in pursuit of his quote unquote own happiness. And that he's having to set that aside in order to be a great man. And I don't know, like that,
that's kind of goofy. I think the chief of staff's looking out for his job. He wants to be happy. Yes. So I don't want the president to be happy.
I think you are absolutely right. I think he was looking out for his own job as well. And it was interesting to me because in my mind, to be disconnected from your heart and be living in a space of either leadership or influence or whatever it might be, but to be disconnected from your heart or not in alignment with who God's created your heart to be, that doesn't to me seem like greatness. That seems like an imposter, or that seems like an obligation versus the ability to live wholeheartedly out of who God's created you to be. And as a result, that is an impactful life in the world around you.
Even the pursuit of greatness is kind of a false thing.
Oh, there's a bit of a yuck meter to that. Absolutely.
Yeah. I want to be great. I had a conversation this week. We were talking about those scriptures where Jesus talks about don't come in and take the chief seats, you know, sit in the back, wait to be invited up. Or we're reading Colossians 3, actually at the end of the verse 4, it says, so choose obscurity. I just go, wow, that's kind of the way to go. It really is a much more fruitful direction to not necessarily pursue greatness, but that's a lot of what our society is about right now, particularly because the income seems to follow how great of an influence you can be.
I mean, yeah, I think the two go hand in hand, this conversation about power and the conversation about money. And somehow we perceive that as greatness, that these people that are pursuing that or living from those spaces, often I would not characterize the impact of their life on the world as great.
Yeah.
Yes. Is it impacting people's lives? Yes. But I don't know if I would categorize it as great.
Yeah. Especially when they're throwing away their marriage, their relationship with their kids, or, you know, the workaholic thing of all, I'm going to be great. So I keep putting the head to the, what's that? Put the head to what? Put the nail to the ground, put the something to the grindstone. That's where I'm going back. Just sickness creeping in on my head. I don't have it.
What about you? Best thing you heard this week?
Well, this is from Thomas Merton. He said it in 1948. So this is a long time ago, but he wrote, "We live in a society whose whole policy is to excite every nerve in the human body and keep it at the highest pitch of artificial tension, to strain every human desire to the limit and to create as many new desires and synthetic passions as possible, in order to cater to them with the products of our factories and printing presses and movie studios and all the rest."
That is a quote from 1948?
Yeah. Well, you didn't see the internet in there. You didn't see TikTok.
Wow.
Not even conceived of. But the idea that that's what big business is doing. It's trying to excite every nerve in your body and keep it at a fever pitch. And then when you're not there getting all those endorphins flowing through your body, then you're depressed and feeling alone. And you're off to find the next thing to titillate and excite you.
Oof.
Now, put that alongside this from C.S. Lewis, not too long after Thomas Merton wrote his deal. He said, "This, I think, one little part of what Christ meant by saying, this is, I think, one little part of what Christ meant by saying that a thing will not really live unless it first dies. It is simply no good trying to keep any thrill. That is the very worst thing you can do. Let the thrill go. Let it die away. Go on through that period of death until the quieter interest and happiness that follows. And you will find you are living in a world of new thrills all the time. But if you decide to make thrills your regular diet and try to prolong them artificially, they will all get weaker and weaker and fewer, and you will be bored, disillusioned old man for the rest of your life." That's C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity.
Oof, gosh, I need to go back and reread Mere Christianity again. That is so good.
Both of those are really good. Together, gosh. Yeah, that society's trying to titillate you, excite you, thrill you. And boy, the formulaic way it does that, when you start seeing through that stuff, what movies are, what influences are, it's all people trying to make money and trying to keep your eyes by whatever means they possible. And when you see through all that, you see why chasing it, at the end leaves you just empty and disillusioned. I love the idea of letting the thrill die. Whatever you got to be part of that was thrilling for you, let it go and see what next thrill comes instead of chasing that one down and beating it to death.
Or trying to maintain that fever pitch, right? I mean, I feel like so often, especially when we are considering the romantic world, we think about, oh, we're going to stay at this fever pitch of passion and desire and love for one another and intimacy. And yet it's like, that is not sustainable. I mean, to let that thrill go, then in my opinion, allows us to be able to really begin to see at a deeper level, day-to-day thrills with an incredible individual that we didn't honestly really know. And especially in the romance, the honeymoon period, at least for me anyway, I had a very idealized view of my wife. And now 13 years later, almost 14 years later, I have a very different snapshot of the woman that she is in comparison to this idealized perspective that I had when I was first dating and marrying her.
Yeah. If we can't grow with life, then the love's going to die. If you're still looking for the same thrill you had on your honeymoon, every day when you're 30, 40, 50 years into it. But if you're finding what each stage of the marriage opens the door to, knowing each other better, loving each other more deeply, not trying to cling, particularly as you get older, like Sarah and I are these days, everything's different than it used to be. Just even your physical body and how it moves, how it functions. And learning to just ride with that, ride with how life unfolds instead of always trying to hold on to something back there somewhere. And you're right, it doesn't work.
And I've been reflecting more back on the adventure from Scotland. And I was laughing at the email that you sent me from, let me see who the letter was from.
It was from Sean.
From Sean. So I was laughing as Sean was apologizing for the experience.
Of the entire UK.
On behalf of the entire UK. Sean, I just want to give you a shout out. It was more United's problem, the United Airlines problem, than it was anything to do with the UK or the citizens of the UK.
You know, United Airlines has lawyers, right?
Oh, good for them. If you're watching what United is going through right now, I mean, every week there's something going on with their airline or they're grounding something or other. Anyway.
Yeah, be nice.
We'll just step off of that pedestal. But one of the things that I was reflecting back on the experience was the way that I responded to this trip that Jess and I just did in Scotland versus the way that I would have responded within the first 3 years of our marriage. I would not have responded well if it was like within the first couple of years of our marriage and we're doing this trip and we're constantly facing adversity and things are falling apart. And honestly, I would not have responded very well.
I hear you.
And yet, over the years of God softening my heart and doing work in my life, God bringing a deeper level of trust in my marriage with Jess and us just being at rest with each other in a new way, it created a completely different adventure experience than before. And I liked this trip to Scotland more than if she and I would have actually lived out this dream that we had had 14 years ago. When we were just newlyweds, I don't think it would have been nearly the fulfillment and the joy and the relationship building experience that we would have wanted it to be. Because just knowing who I was back then.
Or how much I would have been blaming God when I was younger. Like, God, what do I do? You get 5 days here and you get the airline's all messed up. And
don't you care about me, God? Like, don't you care about my like, oh, God. Yeah. Oh, my word.
Yeah. I got a couple of emails to read. April said this: I so enjoyed your 1000th podcast, remembering all the blessings of the past on the God journey. I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for opening your hearts to having these conversations. I started listening to the podcast during a time of great pain when we felt rejected by our church because our teenage son was asking all the wrong questions. And we felt like we were only there to be program fodder. Listening to the God Journey was a drink of refreshing water in a dry desert. I grew up in an almost puritanical denomination, was taught that we only hear God's voice through the Bible. I could never fully believe that, but didn't trust anything else. I didn't trust the nurses and doctors who worked with me and thought were they going to kill me when they put me into some treatment. At one point, as I was lying on the OR table, I heard a whisper in my heart that said, "If you're going to trust me, you will have to trust them." At that moment, I laid back and surrendered. And from then on, I continued to improve and God has fully healed me. Isn't that beautiful?
Wow.
That whole resistance of circumstance is so us. So just, you know, we got the magic God supposed to put his pixie dust on everything that's going on around us. And we're not supposed to be in ORs or we're not supposed to, you know, God, come on, where are you? And just if you want to trust me, entrust yourself to them because that's what's happening now. And it was a point of real healing for her, which I thought was beautiful.
The thing that I really love about that is when we talk about, at least for me anyway, me asking God to wave his magic pixie dust wand.
Well, that's a lot of mixed metaphors there.
the result always is towards comfort. It's like, okay, God, I want you to remove whatever adversity, like discomfort, pain, struggle that I'm feeling. I want you to go ahead and wave your wand and eliminate this and make me comfortable again. And gosh, like I think back to that and I get those prayers. Like I understand that. I still understand those because when I'm struggling and going through hard times, but my prayer posture has definitely shifted as I've learned to trust him, as I've learned what his love looks like. And as I've learned that he walks through it with me. And honestly, the benefit of pressing through some of those things, like I still don't know how we landed in the space where the Christian life is God stretching out his hand and giving us a perfectly smooth, no bumps, straight path in front of us that we get to just gently walk along throughout our lifetime. I don't know where that came from.
Because we cherry pick scriptures, those boxes with all these little promises in them. The affliction shall not draw near the tent of the righteous, and God will heal all your diseases. And we've got all these little cherry pick promises and forget that in the context of the story, people following Jesus or people following God in the Old Testament are going through some pretty deep, dark water.
Yeah.
And there's things about setting a table in the presence of my enemies. Well, yeah, it's nice he's setting a table, but look where it's happening. And there's so much else in scripture if you get a fuller heart of it rather than the faked up promises. What's amazing is how long it lasts when it doesn't work and how much disillusionment people feel. But the folks who aren't going through it at the moment, they're kind of, oh, well, it's too bad they're having that. But, you know, if they were closer to Jesus, they wouldn't be going through that until it hits you.
Yes.
And then the disillusionment that comes with, God, you're not fixing this. How come you're not fixing this? How come am I not praying enough? Am I not fasting enough? Am I not doing? And then jump up on the performance treadmill and wear ourselves out all over again.
Which is also why I think we try to distance ourselves from people who are going through discomfort, right? And we give them this, the perfect scripture, or I will pray for you, or the spiritual platitudes of here, this, that, and whatever. And yet it's all about, we've talked about that before, it's all about satiating our own feeling of discomfort. It's like, my world's okay. My pond is smooth. Please don't throw a rock in it. Don't cause ripples here. Like I will pray from you from afar as long as you don't cause any major waves in my life.
Yeah. And Dieter wrote us this from Germany. As you once said, God is not always nice, but true. Once 35 years ago, when I was involved in church, found myself sleeping 4 hours a night, had three church ministries on top of attending a Bible school. He spoke to me, "You are lazy and unfaithful to me." Wow, how mad I was. But then I listened when he shared in love that what he meant, to see my brokenness, destruction sin produces. I do not want to miss because it leads me to him. There I have a little problem with sin, simply to me or overwhelming it. Does that sound weird that God might see sin like trauma? I do not want to see it like that. Or is this my self-flagellation tendencies? Sin is wonderfully dealt with when a one-on-one confessing in a safe area of love with God or other followers of Christ. Yeah. It'd be interesting. You're working your tail off for God, and God said you're being lazy and unfaithful because you're not doing anything I want you to do. You're doing all this other stuff to keep busy and try and earn my favor, earn my love. And there's no end of ways that people and organizations want to use our busyness to further their kingdom.
Yeah, exploit that to the hilt, that's for sure. Wow.
Well, Lord willing, Sarah and I are about to head out to parts unknown coming up. Make it to come by see you guys. We've gotten the RV all checked out and seems to be working. So we got a few health issues we still have to clear, or this trip's not going to happen. But right now it looks like we're about in the 80% probably will happen. And, okay. It's interesting because I've had a whole lot of people along the route we were thinking of going, and I have to see how it works out. But a lot of people from this group I met with in Boise, it's an international group of folks, and a lot of them said, "Hey, can you come to our town? Can you come here? Can you come there?" And they're kind of on a route where we'd be able to do a number of those. And wow. It just seems more and more God's opening a door for me to stand alongside some folks who are going through a very difficult time in their life. And in fact, this Sunday, I'm doing a 90-minute Zoom session with people from all over the place that are part of that group, just to ask questions and kind of just be alongside them.
So give me a little bit of a synopsis of the experience that some of these individuals are coming out of. You've mentioned like the 2x2 world. You've said some things that it kind of fell in the category of more of a cultish type experience, but What's like a snapshot of the world that these individuals are coming out of? What is that? Give me a brief overview of it.
Well, they're coming out of something that for many of them, it's in third and fourth generation. So they've been in it a long time. Families are involved. I think most of them had their eyes open to the problem when this child sexual abuse, part of a number of the leadership, became more known, or their workers, I think they call them, or they call them leaders. And that kind of opened their eyes to something's wrong here and we can't take it anymore. But it's also, it's a very stringent legalistic lifestyle that they produce. Particularly attacks the way women dress, act, whatever. Every woman is responsible for every man's temptation, which it's just a mark of these very conservative things. And then as always I hear when I'm with people like this, and I've been with quite a few of these groups that are ultra heavy on the rules, and you got to jump through these hoops to have the guarantee of your salvation, and you can be excommunicated and shamed, and then you're no longer saved because the group gets to decide that. And it's, I have had a number of opportunities to just walk with people during this time of transition. Brad and I did a podcast a long time ago. It was kind of off that thing about, you know, when God closes one door, he opens another. And someone said, yeah, but it's hell in the hallway. And it was actually called Hell in the Hallway was the podcast. And I this is that time when you've been in this group, you're comfortable, you know the rules, you play along. It may not be life-giving a lot, but these people seem to have a lot of life. They do. So I don't know how all that fits in. But and now you find yourself having to make a decision to leave something that you have believed for decades that assures your salvation, just your participation in the group. And now you're toying with leaving that. And the amount of courage it takes to push away from something like that's why I admire people like this. I admire people who are willing to make a generational decision that's going to affect them and their families. And some, you know, some parents are leaving, kids still in it, or parents still in it, and kids are leaving. So it risks breaking up families. It risks all kinds of things. But to have the courage to just say, I can't do this anymore the way it is. And because I admire that choice so much, I enjoy being with people at this time in their life when the tendency is to grab something that looks like what we had, but maybe this one's just better. This is going to be people, if we do it, we could do the same thing and we'll have better leadership who's not making the mistakes. And that's our tendency. We try to recreate. How much did the children of Israel want to go back to Egypt for meals? You know, forget all the bricks you had to make. Forget all that stuff. We had meals and they were eating every day. God was providing what they needed in the wilderness, but still the lure of that. And It's one thing, we joke about this all the time, it's really true. It's one thing to get out of something like that. It's another thing to get its imprint out of you, because so much of the way you think, where you feel like your signposts are to whether I'm good with God or not, are marked on pretty false markers. And so being able to take a step at this time and step back and say, okay, what does a journey in Jesus really look like? And where it is that I might want to begin this part of the journey? When I went to Boise, the questions were, okay, what do we do about fellowship? Mm-hmm. And what do we do? Where to from here? And how do we get together? When do we get together? What do we do? And I said, that's the focus 2,000 years has put on the church as a meeting, not the church as a people.
Yeah.
And so my first thing is I love telling people, hey, you know what? Spend some time connecting with Jesus. That whole thing about when you got saved, did someone tell you take the next 2 years and sort out how deeply loved you are by God? And no one was given that opportunity. And I wasn't given that opportunity. My group wasn't near that legalistic, but some of this group seemingly is not that different, other than the whole rules for women and that kind of thing. Not a whole lot different from a lot of denominations that find godliness as jumping through a bunch of rules. And for women, no makeup. And hearing some of the women talk is really interesting, particularly as young girls, that they were forced to go to school and look conspicuous by their difference. And the boys were not. The boys, nothing they wore that the other boys were wearing in school made them stand out.
Yeah.
But the girls all looked like, you know, something's wrong there, and they're not the real cool kids. And so they've got to fight that their whole life as young kids, not their whole life, but their child life, and going to schools and feeling conspicuous by a mode of dress that you wouldn't even want to wear. You're not wearing it because you want to. You wear it because you have to.
Okay, so you've talked we've talked a fair bit about the idea of like how do you, you know, taking that time off and really investing and spending some time of getting to know God, learning to live in his love, etc. How do you actually do that though? Where do you actually start? Because I think a lot of people, when they hear that, it could feel very overwhelming because it's like, okay, now I'm operating in a certain level of, and I use air quotes around this, freedom from that system. And yet I still have this imprint that I'm dealing with. I still have these structures that I've known how to do relationship with God for so long. That's my only sense in the, that's my only paradigm. So where do you start in beginning to actually spend some time getting to know who God is in, as you're coming out of something like that? Where do you start with that?
I tell people to start with the very simple prayer that says, God, would you make yourself known to me? And would you help me see it? And not put a lot of pressure to that. And immediately people are thinking, well, I do Bible reading. I got to have a meeting of Christians. I've got to do.
Yep.
Because what we've learned in our more legalistic points is I feel guilty if I don't.
Yes.
So now when I'm not, I have guilt. And now where do I park that guilt? If I have guilt from not being in a Sunday meeting, then I need another Sunday meeting so I can click that off my thing. And when you live by guilt, it's going to be very hard to recognize Jesus making himself known to you. So I really, that's why the 2-year thing is important. I mean, it's not a legalistic requirement, my goodness.
Yeah.
But if you don't have the pressure of, I got to get somewhere by next month, that helps. Take a deep breath, take a real pause, and begin to talk to Jesus. Ask him, what is it about your love you want to show me today? And then just look for it as you go through the day. Don't, if you get to the end of the day and see anything, then fine. It's no harm, no foul. It's not the finding that's important. It's the seeking. It's just the opening of your heart. And it takes a while for people to begin to learn to live out of their heart instead of learning to live out of the rules. So I tell people the only way guilt dies is when you ignore it. If you feed it, okay, I feel guilty, so I'm just going to go to something over there so I can come home and on Sunday, and then the rest of the day is mine. I feel fine because I've done my thing today. If you don't let guilt die, it will continue to own you. And you'll be following rules instead of following him. So I tell people, find the place where you feel at rest and you feel connects you to God. For me, that's a walk in the woods. There's a specific chair in Sarah's garden that I sit in, and I God doesn't always show up there. It's not where he lives, but I'm more restful there and often more able to see what it is that God's showing me. And so that prayer of God, help me see you today. Help me see your fingerprints. Mm-hmm. And particularly when you've left something like that, I think it's good to go back and know where did God kind of poke holes in my illusions about that. And I didn't see what it was right away. So I kept my nose to the grindstone. That's the expression I was looking for earlier. Keep the nose to the grindstone. And now it's good to say, oh, so Jesus was inviting me into something. Yeah. And I missed it. And not having any guilt about that. Because I think there's a lot, particularly the older you are, when you come out of something that you turn around and realize how soul numbing that was. That you end up with a lot of regrets, you know, gosh, I wasted 50 years of my life with this group or six. And just, I invite people not to go there because if you're going to grow, you're going to always have regrets. I wish I knew when Sarah and I got married, what it was that she was dealing with. I wish Sarah knew that. I wish we could have at least 10 years into our marriage been tuned into this trauma and been part of a healing journey. But I tell you what, 10 years into our marriage, we didn't have those tools. We didn't have that knowledge. We'd probably try to cast out a demon or something silly and it not happen. And then we've been all disillusioned with God again. So God, I love the idea that God has a trajectory in of our life. And what I'm discovering at 72 now, that this justice, righteousness thing, this gazing with God stuff, I mean, there's been so much in the last few years going, oh my gosh, this would have saved me so much grief if I would have known this earlier. I don't go there because I said, I just rejoice. I get to know it now. Yeah. And I'm glad I didn't die not knowing this. Now, I don't know what I'm going to die still not knowing. I'm sure it's going to be plenty. Yeah. But when I see things like that, I wish I had known this earlier. I just say, but I know it now. And if I was 50 years thick for God to keep tearing down in Wayne what tried to manufacture a spiritual life that was more of his choosing than God's, so that I could learn to live loved, so that I could learn what trust is, so I could be more open to the things that he reveals in my life. And that journey has to begin. Number one is I've got to come to rest in God's love and care for me and not chase the guilt demon around my house.
Okay, so do you feel like those things, when you're looking back, are those regrets or are they laments? Like, because when I think about regret, I think about something that usually is authored by fear. Like, so I was trying to follow my heart, either my own fear or somebody else's fear swayed me to go a different direction and not pursue something that my heart was, or that I felt like God was leading me to do. Uh-huh. Versus a lament where it's like, yeah, like if I would have known some of the things that I know about my own heart, about trauma, about how my body responds to it, in comparison to 14 years ago when Jess and I first started dating, yeah, I would have loved to have been able to know those things. And yet part of the whole reason why I even know them to begin with is because of the beauty of my relationship with my wife and how that has produced those things. Right. And so I feel like it's more of a lament of, man, I wish that I would have known those things, because I would not have wanted to impact the person that I love with that kind of pain, or hurt their heart, or, you know, that type of thing. I feel like that's more of a lament than a regret of, oh, like if only I would have, versus I wish it would have been X. Does that make sense? Or am I splitting hairs here?
If that works for you, I look at lament and regret pretty much the same thing. But
okay.
Yeah, I don't draw that kind of distinction, but I might from now on, having heard you describe it. The regrets I have is I wish I hadn't spent 15 years in a spiritual machine trying to fix it, instead of finding the freedom from God not having to inhabit structures, and God being more relational, and God wanting to have a relational connection with us and our relational connection with other people, rather than managing all the programs. Now, it's not saying God didn't do good things through all that, because I don't think it was a complete wash or waste. But I can remember the frustration. It felt like trying to put a square peg in a round hole. The life of Jesus I hungered for, and the delivery system we'd created and tried to cram it into. And so I have a regret about spending, let me say, I look back with regret that I didn't know better. But I don't hold that very long at all anymore. I just go to, oh, but I know now. And I learned a lot through that. I can go back to those places and go, man, 15 years trying to hone our own faith community in a more human effort kind of way, learned a lot. Mostly what doesn't work, but we learned a lot. Maybe that precedes what it is that God was able to show us later and take you on a different journey. But, and some of those things didn't come because I saw great truth and went and pursued it. I got kicked out. Yeah. And now, okay, so God, what do we do? And so much of my life has been that way. That's why I loved April's letter of just being able to say, if you're going to trust me, you've got to trust this process, whether it's a surgeon, whether it's stuff going on in your family that you can't control, whether it's stuff going on with Sarah being gone, and being able to say, oh, and God saying, this is not what it appears to be, which turned out to be dead right. Yeah. But at the time, I was so afraid. Oh my gosh, if this is wrong, I'm a fool. But I love the way God has led us to it. And if people ask me, do you have regrets? I would say, I wished I'd learned some things sooner. But I also know when people ask me, what would the Wayne of today tell 25-year-old Wayne? And I'd say, I have a lot to tell him, but I don't think he would have heard any of it. I don't think he would have listened.
See, I got into a really interesting conversation with my cousin around this exact topic just this week. And we were exploring we were talking about regrets and laments and looking back on your life and saying, I wish I would have known blank about blank, right? And yet, one of the things that we were really wrestling with is, would we have been able to appreciate and genuinely receive the gift that God gave us in replacement of it if we hadn't navigated and negotiated some of the challenges that we had? So, like, I think about the times that I had spent trying to figure out a place for me in the system and finding a way to perform in the religious.
And to be great. And to be great.
Yes, and to be great at it. Absolutely. To be yes. A rock star at
me
it.
Me too. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I hear you.
And yet I think about it was the times of me really banging my head against the wall, of really trying things, of expending the effort, that when God finally stepped, I think he was giving me an invitation the whole time to step out of it.
I agree. Yep.
But when I actually heard him, after failing in that pastoral internship for a year solid, that's when I was able to genuinely not only hear him, but appreciate the difference between the journey that he was extending me and the performance that I was trying to live on my own. And there was just we were talking about how, like, for example, if can you genuinely experience and know what love is if you haven't experienced some form of heartache? Can you genuinely extend grace to another person if you haven't received grace or experienced or let grace into your own life for your own things that you've had to navigate? And we were talking about that dichotomy, that comparison of, can you really appreciate? So for example, can you really appreciate the God journey if you haven't been on the hamster wheel for a period of time? If you haven't gotten caught up in the snares of the religious performance and the depravity of human system and religion, if you haven't had to wrestle with some of that, can you genuinely experience the invitation of wholehearted life in Christ? I don't know. I what are your thoughts on that?
I would like to think maybe we wouldn't have to go through that road. So I hope God's big enough, but it seems like most of us have. Paul the apostle, I mean, he was the Pharisee of Pharisees, and he was doing horrible stuff. And I mean, Jesus could have talked to him back when he was here on the earth and found him and said, "Hey, man, why don't you give this up and come with me?" But it waits till after Pentecost, after the church is growing, and Paul's still, and then God said, "Okay, let's fix this one up." It seems like God is immeasurably patient with the process he has for us and what circumstances and hungers, and I think those two go side by side, what circumstances and hungers call that life out of me, call that passion to know God. And I don't look at everything I believed back in the more legalistic days as wrong. Some of it's beautiful. Some of it still lives in my heart. But the idea of that we could get there, that's always the trick. We could get there by human effort. If we just worked harder, if we did more, and then you're all focused on human effort, and it's frustrating because it doesn't work. And so you get something close, but it's not really what you had. It's not what you idealized in your mind it could be. And so then you double down on more effort and more Bible reading, more prayer time, more whatever. And I just... all the exhausting things we did when Jesus said, "I just want to walk with you, Wayne, through your life." And there'll be times I'll nudge you into something I think would be fun for us to do together, but I've not got you every day needing you to work hard for me. I don't need that. I need you just to love me and to let that love grow so that it displaces the more unhealthy parts of your personality that got twisted by darkness. And that's a beautiful journey. And people who miss that because... And that's the danger of these groups of just trying to create something that's like that, which is always going, and you always see it, whether it's a house church movement was an attempt to do that, where you still have the mini concert, mini lecture. It's just mini, mini more. It's still singing, praying, prayer requests, and somebody's got to give a teaching from the Bible. And it doesn't allow us to encourage each other to live in the love of God and to share that love together and become friends first. Instead, we become people centered on a meeting first, and then friendships never flow from that. I think once you get the friendships growing, now you can be together and talk about things and do things that'll spur one another on to love and good deeds, but not from a matter of works, just from a matter of encouragement and life. And don't we want to be inside this life of Jesus the way he wants to show it to us.
Well, I think it's even a huge leap, especially for people who are transitioning. Well, I'll just speak to my own journey. When I was transitioning out of that need to succeed and be great in the religious evangelical Christian community, it was a huge leap to move from shame to guilt. You know, even the mindset of my mind of, no, I am a bad person. Not just I'm making a bad decision or I'm not behaving appropriately, but I am, my value is being diminished by me not showing up to X, Y, and Z, or me not being able to do this thing or have these scriptures perfectly memorized or be standing on this big of a stage.
Or not have a leader you respect affirm you.
Yes.
Instead embarrass yes. you. Yeah, yeah. That's that shame that just washes over. And
yeah. And so to even move to the point where it's like, okay, I'm experiencing guilt. Like, is this behavior good or not by going to that thing? Like, that's a completely different thing than the feeling of, oh, I'm an evil person. My salvation is genuinely in question right now if I don't do blank. And that movement away from that and God being able to untangle that.
And if I don't get the approval of blank.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway, we'll be talking more about this stuff. And just want to offer this too, because we're getting ready to leave on the 24th, I think, is when we're trying to leave. So it's a week and a half away. We're not sure we're going to get a God Journey podcast in every week while we're on the road. That's going to depend on some things. We'll do it when we can. We got some stuff to talk about. So if it's a little haphazard for the next few weeks, don't worry about it. If a new one's not up there, we're still probably fine. And we'll just have another one when we can get to it. So hope that's okay with everyone. The routing, if you're interested, we're going to Denver first and then up through Rapid City, South Dakota, over to Sheridan, Wyoming, maybe. Mm-hmm. We invited there.
And absolutely.
Then probably Bozeman, Montana. We're going to try, depending on weather and time, try to get up to Calgary and then back through Canada, maybe down to Coeur d'Alene and then turn west and don't know where we'll end up yet. And we get into Oregon and Washington and Washington and Oregon and then head home from there. So should be fun. We're looking forward to it, Sarah and me and the pups. And so if you're along that route and want to touch base, let us know. And we'll love to check in with you if we've got the time. The energy, and a lot of this has to do with Sarah's growing calmness. And so we don't go at a fever pitch, and there'll be places we may be that we won't meet because Sarah needs some space just to be in the woods with me.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.